Yeah, but the Freedom Tower is quite far uptown compared to the Battery. And yes, the Battery is rather lowland, and the subway stations in that area are flooded rather well. I think that was, they probably consider that a once per 100-year event. Is that true, Eric?
No, you have to change that because of the global climate change. No, but that whole area got pretty damn flooded. Don't forget, the World Trade Center, even though you're thinking it's more uptown, it doesn't necessarily mean more elevation. This used to be when you look over the side of the World Trade Center when it was there, you could literally see the, you could see where Steve, what's his name, docked his big boat, which was like one block over. So I can't imagine that it's 100 feet rise between where the dock is and where the building is. If anything, I think it's only like 20 feet or something in that neighborhood.
And the water does tend to run into the basement, so to speak. They had to do some fancy things to waterproof the basement of the World Trade Center when it was there. Okay, we're going to go back to Steve. KC2QFJ, K2RIW, go right ahead, Steve.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I'm trying to identify a mystery antenna that I bought at a ham fest a few years back. It's a vertical antenna, about approximately 9 feet tall. I'm guessing it might be a TV antenna. It's fed with a gamma match at the bottom. So it's really, it has no markings whatsoever as far as brand or anything, but it doesn't seem to be homebrew. It has a electrocution hazard sticker on it, but no manufacturer or anything. So what's really interesting is it has these two J-shaped, I guess they call them appendages, about half, a third and two-thirds of the way up the side. They're made out of 1/8-inch solid, into a J-shape. The long part of the J is about 19 inches long. And it's insulated from the main part of the antenna. And I'm wondering if anyone is familiar with this kind of antenna and that sort of structure of these two stubs or whatever they are mounted on the side.
And what does the base of it look like, Jeff? Are there any radios coming off from the base, Steve?
It didn't come with any radios, but since I bought it at a ham fest, it's quite likely pieces were missing. I'm not sure if there's any attachment point. I don't have it with me, and unfortunately forgot my notes where I had written all that down, so I apologize for that, but no, I don't know of any radio.
Is there a fiberglass radome over it? What is the diameter of the antenna near the base?
Just regular tubing, 3/8 or 7/16 inch diameter tubing, and slightly smaller as it goes up.
So I think you're saying it's a telescoping aluminum rod with some doodads, doodads hanging off the sides. Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. And as I said, a gamma match at the bottom of kind with the piece of tubing and the center conductor and dielectric off of a coax inside.
Okay. Anybody within the listening, within the area of my voice, do they recognize that antenna? Any clues? Give me some call letters. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Kind of sounds like a DX Engineering HF antenna.
What band do you think it covers, Eric?
I think it might be just, they make one that's just high band. It's 20, 15, and 10. But they also make a bigger one. But I'm not sure because you've not given me enough detail.
Okay. So what brand name and what model number do you think you should look to see if the picture in the advertisement follows what he's got? Give us a hint what you think it is, Eric.
I'll go through the DX Engineering catalog. So, you know, it's online. It may be one of those.
Sounds like you've got a pretty good lead there, Joe. KC2QFJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, know an antenna wise, antenna analyzer will tell you real quick.
Yeah, if you sweep it, you're saying that, depending on how it's mounted, if it doesn't have any ground plane radials, if he puts it on a short pipe or a long pipe, he's going to get different answers, I think, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true, but it's not going to be that far away that you wouldn't be able to tell.
Could it be maybe like a 10-meter Ringo?
A Ringo without the ring on the bottom? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Don't all the Ringo antennas have a ring at the bottom, Rich? K2UPS, I think it is, K2LAW.
Oh, that's why they're called Ringos.
That's correct. I believe it's a gamma match, but he didn't say what shape it was in. But if it wraps around it, then I would say that someone just said giveaway that it could be one of the Ringo antennas. But the little J things he said that are hanging out, that's throwing me off. So, not sure what that would be. I know they make a collinear Ringo, which they used to for 2 meters, as well as a half wave one, but they also made one for 6 and for 10 meters. So it might be something like that. I don't know how old it is.
The gamma match that's at the bottom, Steve, give us a pretty good description of what that gamma match on the bottom looks like. And is there any holes where ground plane radials could be plugged into? KC2 QFJ, K2LIW.
It's just a straight piece of tubing, I think about 8 inches long. It's those 2J appendages that were really mysterious to me. At the time I bought it, I did look through all the vertical antennas that were advertised and cataloged. I didn't see anything that looked like that. So that was the mystery more than anything, was the J appendages. I don't have an antenna analyzer to put on it, or I would have done so, but I'll have to get some more measurements and check for the radio attachment points and come back next week.
The pair of J appendages, how far up the mast? Where are they located, Steve?
Approximately 3 feet and about 5.5 or 6 feet up the mast.
This connection stop, but somebody's obviously using this net.
Does that fit any of the mental images you have, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, I'm looking through their catalog now. That sounds like an HF antenna to me, because there's a bunch of them that do that. I'm not finding the ones that I can remember, but it looks like CX has gone into selling other people's stuff instead of their own, so. There are others. For example, my R7's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, it covers all the bands, including the walk band, so there's little appendages all over the antenna. But I've seen in the past just 20, 15, and 10-meter antennas with, it looks like a damn solid piece of telescopic tubing with a couple of J appendages on it. So at this point, your guess is as good as mine.
Now, getting back to television for a minute, Eric, branded channel 47, I'm kind of amazed at that not-so-popular, not-so-well-known channel is apparently the very first channel to physically move over to the Freedom Tower. In the near future, to your knowledge, who else is about to move over to the Freedom Tower? And you have reason to believe that some of the guys on Empire, for whatever reason, are going to stay there and not move over to Freedom Tower. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well,
everybody put their deposit down on three different towers, so everybody has the capability of moving there, but as far as I know, there's only three of us at this point, and that's all in flux. I mean, I know that we're definitely there. We know that NBC, and by the way, don't say 47 is not popular, you just don't speak Spanish, so you have no reason to watch it. As far as the Spanish community, it's the bigger one. I mean, there's others, but they got the biggest audience. And besides that, they're NBC. They're just NBC in Spanish. K2RW, K2JAN.
Yeah, there's quite a few Spanish channels. Let me think now. I think it's 24-12345. I think it's almost all Spanish. It's a 24 or 23. It's the one above 21, but below 25. 67-1 and 2, 68-1 and 2, they're always Spanish. There's a few of them in the lower 60s. So I guess we've got one-third as many Spanish channels in New York City as we do English-speaking channels. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
You also have Chinese. You got a bunch of those. You got Indian. You got a couple of those, although you can't pick them up because they're pointed the other way. And there's another foreign language station. I forget what it is. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff there besides the big four.
The Indian channel that's published that's aimed the other way. Tell me what branded channel number they are, Eric.
Right now it's, I'm pointing towards New Jersey. That's where their audience is. And there's a small antenna that covers a small area of Queens. They're currently on 36, and I think they moved. I don't remember where they moved to. But, yeah, it's not only Indian. I think they also have a Thai language station there. As one of their streams. Actually, there's four major streams going on in that channel. Two of them are Indian.
The 36 you mentioned, is that the RF frequency? What's the branded channel number?
That's 36. Hang on, let me look it up. I believe the branded channel and the air channel is 36 at the moment.
I might have seen them from time to time. Now I'm not sure. Above 33, there's a whole bunch of channels before I hit 41. I think that's 36. Yep, I think I see a whole bunch of channels above 33, but before 41. Over to you, Eric, K2RW.
RF34 is another one down in New York, and there's a lower power station. I can pick them up out here almost all the time.
The station's call sign is WDVB. TV, I just passed it. It's a lot of TV channels that are changing. Get back to the end here. There we go. They were going to sell, but they didn't sell because they weren't offered enough money. So that happened to a number of them here. Let's see, DVB. The listed is New Jersey, I think. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. They're currently on 23, not 36. I don't know what I'm saying. They're on 23. The license is in Edison, and they're on Empire. And they're running almost 7 kilowatts.
Okay. Branded 23. I think I see 5 dash numbers on that one. Erica, go ahead. Almost all of them are Spanish. Although one is... Wait a minute now. No. One of them is Chinese. Most of them are Spanish.
Now, 23 is... Oh, that's 23. I think it's branded as 36. That's where my 36 came from. Whereas what's actually on 36 is branded as 47. And 2EO.
Yeah, you don't watch over the television, Rich. N2EO. So look what you're missing. N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, Dick. Louisa came in here. Have a quick request. Won't take long. before you go to the space report.
Okay, we're ready for you. Go ahead with your question, Rich.
Okay, something I should have asked a long, long time ago, but made me think of it was when Joe mentioned his service monitor. I used to own a WaveTech 3000B. It was in very good shape, even though WaveTech was out of business. I bought it from Hal because he services and sells used test equipment. Just before I moved here, people were in my house, and the WaveTech and a few other pieces of test equipment disappeared. I thought, if there's a good Samaritan out there, especially the WaveTech, I'd like to get it back. Hal said he could pick up the serial number because he keeps on all his receipts, which he keeps a copy of. He keeps the receipts with serial numbers, and he could match it up back to net and to Leo.
Oh, once again, Rich, your WaveTech was what model number?
It was a 3000B.
Okay, WaveTech 3000B. And compared to, say, an IFR, was it similar in size and portability? What did it physically look like, Rich?
Front is white and has black letters. On the very left side, it had a scope, you know, so you could see, deviation, how to set your PL level and all that. Below that, it had a bunch of thumbnail switches. It covered from below 100 cycles all the way up to 999.99 megahertz.
What's your guess as to the year of manufacture when that was popular, Rich? Go ahead.
I really don't know, Dick, but I can tell you it was in excellent condition.
Yeah, that sounds like it's handy. My guess is that could put out, all across that RF frequency region you just mentioned, my guess is you could go up to probably plus 10 dBm and down to minus 80 or something like that by adjusting the output attenuator.
Exactly. It had a variable attenuator. Great, great thing. I loved it. Now, like I say, it disappeared. I don't know who has it, but he said he could supply me with a copy of the bill and the serial number. Hopefully I could get it back. I should have asked many years ago. I don't know why. I'm amazed that I didn't. But, maybe it's not too late.
Okay, we'll tell people to keep an eye out for that. Is there anyone else with any other questions before we go over to the space report? Got any questions on anything ham radio-like? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet. And when it comes to space report, Paul, this week I'm hearing about that spacecraft that's going to go near the sun. It's going to be launched in the next couple of years. At the end of 2018, we're going to be launching the James Webb Space Telescope. That's something to look forward to. So, NASA is in the process of doing some really good things. WS2N, Space Report number 253, I guess it is, or 254. We're about to find out. K2IW, 253, I think it is. You got it, Paul.
Okay, yeah, this is WS2N for SpaceNet Report. Yeah, 253. That could change as time goes on. Holidays, sicknesses, you know how it goes. Right, that's my count. You mentioned the spacecraft that's going to go near the sun. They just renamed it now. They call it the Parker Solar Probe. So they're going to dedicate it to this guy Parker that really came up with the idea of solar wind and, you know, all these things. Really solar weather coming off the sun back in, what, the 1950s or something. So that'll be the name Parker, and then that will go up a little over a year from now. I think it's July of 2018. That would be next year. So that's quite a probe. It's going to be launched on a Delta IV Heavy. That's our heaviest version of any of our rockets that NASA uses. And it's really like three Delta IVs bolted together. So Delta IV, you know, they run these liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines in that thing. RS-V8 engines, I think they're called. So you'll have that pushing this relatively small probe all the way to near the sun. So Parker probe will get very close, you know, way inside the Earth, the orbit of Mercury. Going to get down to actually below 4 million miles to the surface of the sun. Before it starts taking all its readings and looking at the temperatures, trying to figure out why the chronosphere is so hot. The chronosphere is hotter than the surface of the sun. And they expect a lot of surprises with this. Anytime they launch these rockets, they try to guess what they're going to find. A lot of times they're right, but then there's always things that they didn't come up with that do come up. So we look forward to that next year. They've got a carbon-carbon front to this probe to protect the spacecraft. Carbon-carbon was commonly used on the leading edge of the wings of the shuttle and the nose to protect it when it re-entered the atmosphere. So it's very successful as far as that goes. Unless, of course, you know, something hits it. It is very breakable if you hit something hard enough with it. You had the Columbia shuttle had foam coming off the external tank and it's almost in the frozen mode, hitting the front of the wing at probably 600 miles an hour or something like that, cracking the, putting a hole in the carbon-carbon and causing the destruction of Columbia back in 2003. But with this probe, you won't have that problem at the top end of the Delta IV rocket when it goes off, and it should be very interesting. Let me drop WS to my screen.
I just did a quick calculation, Paul. When you're 4 million miles from the surface of the sun, and the sun is around 850,000 miles in diameter, let me drop it. Your next question is, how big will the angular extent of the sun be? And the answer is about 13 degrees. From where we sit on the Earth, you look at the sun, it's an object half a degree wide. When you're at this Parker Solar Probe, it will see the sun as an object 13 degrees wide. That's a pretty big, hot object. So that shield out in front of the Parker Probe has to be big enough in diameter to protect that spacecraft from all of those hot rays coming off there. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I understand that they're going to have a real refrigeration system to help cool down the equipment and the solar panels. So that should be an interesting design when I first see how that comes out. The instruments for detecting things, that's one thing, but try to keep a probe that cool, that should be interesting. couple of other things. NASA brought back two people from space, one European Space Agency astronaut, Thomas Piketty from France. He came back with the Russian commander of the Soyuz. So only two people came back successfully, about 2 days ago, landing in Kazakhstan. So that worked out good. That leaves three people on board the space station. There were five. And they usually are sick, but they got involved with the Russians trying to cut back. And now that's all going to be reversed now because of more money from NASA. We'll be paying probably for two people to go up at a time instead of having a vacant seat. But right now there's three people on board. At the end of July there'll be a total of six again when the next expedition crew goes up. And one other thing I forgot to mention, the WS plan. I don't know if you still have Newsday in the house. Today's Newsday, but almost 2 weeks ago, my daughter, N2WIN, had our students, 12 students, contact us, questions of Jack Fisher on the International Space Station. So it wound up coming out in today's Newsday. Jack Fisher, K2FSH, of course, he didn't use the call letters with NA1SS. But if you look on in Newsday page, what is it? It's on the main section, page 27. You'll be able to see that. She's got the picture of the class in the background there. I don't know if you saw Newsday, Dick. Back to you, WS line.
I wonder if that picture looks somewhat like we saw in the YouTube video of your daughter during that event, Paul. Go ahead. And congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We had some meetings at school, and it went on for over a year to set that whole thing up. Lon Monke even got involved with helping us out, giving us some answers. We had a communication day, and we brought two meter and HF radio into the school, set up antennas, and they had a lot of education throughout the school year for all the grades, zero all the way up to eighth grade. And what was I going to say about that? The Newsday article came out. We had the local papers had it out here as well. But that picture was from Newsday came in separately and interviewed the principal and the photographs itself of the students and my daughter in there is taken in the library with all the different things that they had, pictures of as jigsaw puzzles of solar system, as all kinds of parts that they made, big rockets and stuff. And then one kid, he's standing right in front of my daughter. He's holding the square like this thing. It almost looks like a book in the picture. Let me drop it. But what it is if you zoomed in on it, like if you just go on a computer and you could actually bring up the same picture. They have the picture on the computer where you bring up the paper or the computer information from Newsday, and you could actually zoom in on it. What that is a tile from NASA, from what they put on the space shuttle. So wrapped in plastic, it's got the, all the identifying marks on it from NASA and all. So that's pretty cool. He's standing there with a tile from the space shuttle, that they use for re-entry. Back to you, Dick. Got to find the paper. Anybody looking for it? Today's paper. This occurred on the 22nd, like 2 Mondays ago. About 13 days ago. Back to you, Dick.
Well, we've got Paul during his space report. I wonder if anyone on frequency has any questions about anything to do with space and NASA and European Space Agency and the European Southern Observatory and so on. Give me a call that is right now, T2RIW.
Yeah, W-H-O-Y-Y. I am just kind of curious, when will the next manned rockets be going up from the U.S.? I know we've been using Soviet stuff for, you know, human transportation, but when is the U.S. going to get when will they be getting back into the business of human transport back to the station, space station? Back to you, Paul? Yeah, Joe, you have lost us. It's 2011 since we flew anybody off the surface of the United States in space, when the last space shuttle retired, STS-135. And since then, the commercial program has been really gearing up. Yesterday, for instance, you had a flight to the International Space Station by SpaceX using the Falcon 9 and the Dragon spacecraft. Dragon spacecraft is a cargo vehicle right now. Bring 6,000 pounds up to the ISS, and we'll be there Monday morning. They'll grab it with the robotic arm and berth it, unload everything, and bring up food and equipment, science stuff for the astronauts. And there's another telescope type thing that they're going to install on the outside of the space station. And these things go up on a regular basis. This is called CRS number 11. That means it's the 11th cargo flight by SpaceX that they're doing for the multi-billion dollar program for NASA. The idea is for SpaceX is to drop the cost down. So they've been capturing boosters. They've captured 10 of them so far. About 5 that have landed in back in Cape Canaveral, and the other remaining 6. Now it's 6 on land and 5 on water. This was the 11th one to return. And the idea is to make space flight cheaper. And they're accomplishing that. They've already relaunched one of the boosters successfully. And by the end of the month, they're going to launch another booster successfully. So they're driving the course down. And the Dragon that went up today on CRS 11 is returning to space. It went up the exact same spacecraft. The Dragon went up on CRS 4, about 2.5 years ago. Yeah, about 2.5 years ago on CRS 4 to the space station. And they're going to be doing more of this, dropping. So they're becoming very confident in, in reusing all their vehicles, driving the price down. The same Dragon they're developing one for a crewed version, which will be able to carry up to 7 people if they wanted to. Most likely it will be 4 people, and they'll be going up to the space station. We'll be bringing our own astronauts up to the space station. In fact, we're going to increase the number of people going from 6 people to 7 people on board the space station. It's regularly 6, it's going to be now 7 once this happens. To answer when this is going to happen, at the very end of this year, they will launch another Falcon 9 with a crewed Dragon attached to it. So it will be unmanned, and that's toward the end of the year, probably like November. And it will go up to the space station, stop at the space station, will even unload some stuff. They'll stay up there for a period of time, a couple of weeks, and then they'll bring it back and land it in the Pacific Ocean like they do with all these cargo vehicles. The spring of next year, 2018, they're scheduled to launch the first crewed vehicle with 2 people on board. test flight. So you'll have one astronaut from NASA and one astronaut, commercial astronaut from SpaceX. Two people will be on board, and they will actually go up to the space station, dock from the space station again, stay for a couple of weeks maybe, and then undock and again land in the Pacific Ocean. They might do it one more time after that, and then NASA will qualify it, and then they can go into regular flight, bringing up astronauts to space station four at a time. And that's only SpaceX. Parallel to this, Boeing has been developing the Starliner. Starliner is about the same size of SpaceX. Capability of bringing up seven people in space if they wanted to, just like SpaceX. Again, most likely four people at a time for the first couple of years. They're a little bit behind SpaceX, so figure the first test flight for them might be the summer of 2018. So a little over a year from now, you'll probably see a crewed version, you know, two people going on the Starliner. Starliner will be launched again from Florida, and that is launched by United Launch Alliance, which is the team, you know, it's Boeing and Lockheed together, you know, that's what they call the United Launch Alliance, and that will be launched on an Atlas V rocket. Atlas V rocket has not flown a person yet. The original Atlas, way back when in the 1960s, flew people like John Lennon to space. Drop it. So for regular commuting to and from the space station, that should be underway by the end of next year. You'll see this on a regular basis. You know, every 3 to 4 months, so you might see another crew going up from the United States. Russia's still going to be launching their rockets, too. So you'll have three possible manned spacecraft going to the space station in the coming years. Not to be outdone, as you have Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC. They're developing the Dream Chaser. The Dream Chaser right now is being developed as a cargo vehicle. That's going to be really a heavy lift capability. They're going to bring up, you know, 10,000-12,000 pounds, where SpaceX can bring up around 6,000 pounds of cargo. So Dream Chaser will go up, dock with the space station. It looks like a small shuttle, undock, and we'll be able to come back and land on a runway. Drop it. That's under development now, and they have it out in California. They're testing it now. I think they'll probably be ready for a drop test within a month or two. I think it's in the summer of this year. The drop test, you know, they'll pick it up on a helicopter and drop it, see how it lands. They know it's viable because they've done it before, years ago. But back then they had a little problem with landing. So this is all redone, completely different. It's really a cargo vehicle. And once it's in operation, they'll be sending cargo to the space station. They already have a contract with NASA. So NASA's already said, you know, you're entitled to six flights to the space station with cargo. After that, as Sierra Nevada Corporation is developing the next version of the Dream Chaser already they have that capable of carrying a crew. Back with what they thought originally, they thought they were going to have the crewed vehicle and eventually, you know, maybe make a cargo vehicle. But NASA really needs the cargo for the space station, so they wanted them to develop that first, and still. Long term, maybe I don't know how many years from now, eventually you'll be sending people up on Dream Chaser and bringing them back and landing on a runway close to the shuttle. And that's about it, Joe. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS.
Got any further questions along those lines, Joe? K2RYY, K2RIW.
Yes. Paul, the spacecraft that's going to be landing on the runway, I forgot what you call it, but is that going to be an unpowered flight coming down like the shuttle where it's basically, for lack of a better term, like a big flying brick? They're going to pretty much do the same thing, or is it going to have some sort of power available for controllability or better controllability?
Their engines can refire, but I don't think that's really going to be an option. They're just going to fly these things in with the weather, you know, in good shape. They'll take it, put it on any runway. They don't need this 3-mile runway to land a Dream Chaser. It's called Dream Chaser. And they don't need that. They can land it in Kennedy if they wanted to. Imagine if they flying in landing at a JFK. They've already got clearance to land at Midland Airfield in Houston. You know, where they have regular planes taking off. So, they're using what I like to call green fuel. They don't have these toxic fumes coming off the spacecraft after it lands. Remember, after the shuttle landed, you'd see guys coming out and they look like hazmat suits and big blowers and stuff, trying to make sure that there's no toxic fumes, the hypergolic fuels. Can't get that on you. Dream Chaser won't have any of that. Completely different fuels. So that's going to be interesting. That's quite an advanced forward move by Sierra Nevada Corporation. In fact, the European Space Agency wants to launch their vehicle, the cargo version, for them from French Guiana. So they're trying to sign them up for that. That's pretty much it.
Repeater, timeout.
That's pretty much it, Joe.
Okay, I hear you, Eric. Now, I was just kind of curious because you said the thing is going to be able to land on a. I know they're not 3-mile runways at Kennedy, like under 2 miles, I think, or something like that. So I thought you'd need some sort of power to be able to help assist you if you've got the flaps down, that type of thing, because without having, any way to slow the thing down or whatever, that thing's going to be coming in pretty fast, and I guess it wouldn't be a long runway, so I guess they've, I guess that's solved that problem. Back over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I heard Eric, but the deal is that, they've been doing this. There's something called the X-37B. It looks kind of like the Dream Chaser quarterback four different times so far. Dick, over to you. I think Eric.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Not to change the subject, but I forgot to mention something earlier. The repeater's going to go off at 12:04, like it always does. But you'll also be able to get back in with from 7:05. So if you go over, 12:04, that's it. You're done. Throw it up your cage for the day.
Does that mean that the link in one direction also gets turned off at this time where it didn't in the past? Is that what's happening, Eric?
That's correct, Dick. So, as long as you're aware of it.
Okay, so if I can't get in by that means, I won't blame my equipment. Paul, some of the things you said earlier, the American launch of astronauts, when they come back, are going to be landing in the ocean. And that's a very safe way. We've got a lot of history of doing that, parachute into the ocean. Since a number of the American spacecraft are experimenting with bringing the various stages of the spacecraft back to a launch pad, is there any future dream of doing that with an astronaut on board, bringing a spacecraft back to a launch pad? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, in the beginning, you know, for the first flights, I don't know how many flights, but SpaceX will bring the Dragon crew version back to the Pacific Ocean, a couple hundred miles off the coast of Baja in California. What they do now with the cargo spacecraft, float to the ocean, they come over, the SpaceX has their own boat, they put it on their own boat, they bring it in, and all the scientists reach inside and grab all their science experiments after efforts on land, and everybody's happy. But scientists would always like to get everything back as early as possible. So the next cargo version, similar size to the cargo version now. The only difference is it's going to have these Super Draco motors on it, or rockets on it, attached to it. So when it deorbits from the space station, they plan on bringing it back to land, probably in Utah or someplace, with propulsive power all the way down. You're going to have heat shield followed by propulsion power. They'll have parachutes in case it's a problem, but that's what they plan on doing. Now it lands, there it is right on land, and scientists could have all their equipment ready, 1, 2, 3. Boeing, on the other hand, has plans of never bringing their Starliner, STS-100 Starliner, back to the ocean. They plan on landing on land in the beginning, dropping. Similar to what the Russians do. Russians land in Kazakhstan. But Boeing plans on coming down with a heat shield, parachute, and then right at the very end, or near the end, the heat shield separates, exposing these airbags that are going to blow up. There's six airbags around the entire bottom of the Boeing Starliner spacecraft. The crew on board. And airbags open up, in the last few seconds. And that stops the blow when they hit the ground. So that's their plan. SpaceX has long-term plans to be cargo version of the propulsion system with the Super Draco engine that they're going to land on the ground with cargo work dropping. As the years go by, the flights to the Pacific Ocean become increasingly routine. The next step for SpaceX will be putting these Super Draco engines inside the crew version, and you're going to come out of the detach from the space station, come down with the heat shield, and then parachute just in case, it's not going to open for emergencies. Super Draco engines are going to come on, and they're going to have a propulsive landing all the way back to land. At that point, you'd be able to come down to, let's say, landing zone one, where the boosters land, or some other landing facility. That's the story. That's the long-term plan, Dick. So yes, they eventually plan on bringing astronauts right back to where they started if they wanted to, back to there.
The Soyuz, when it lands on land, does it use that technique of inflating an airbag behind the heat shield, and the heat shield comes out some distance from the bottom of the spacecraft, and therefore that hits the ground first and softens the impact? Is that the way Soyuz does it now, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
No, they don't do that. They come down with the heat shield. They have people, you'll see after that, you see one big parachute. And, which maybe 1 year ago, Apollo always came back with three big parachutes. The Blue Origin comes back with I think three or four parachutes. Same thing with SpaceX. And in case one fails, you have some kind of safety there. You could still make it back down to the ground. In fact, Blue Origin has the same thing. They have a planned space manned spacecraft as well. Won't see that for quite a few years, but that's in the planning. That they're going to launch eventually from the new Glenn rocket that Blue Origin is building from the water, which is almost the size of the Saturn V rocket. But Soyuz comes down with each yield, one big parachute. And if that one parachute fails, another one comes out and does the same thing, opens up. So that's their system. They have a second parachute ready to open if needed. It's never been used. So one big parachute has always worked for them. But you do have a backup. Now when they come down closer to the land, about a mile, I guess a couple mile up or so, each shield separates from the Soyuz spacecraft. And as they get close to the ground, I mean the last couple of seconds, you'll see a big puff of smoke coming off these things when you watch the replays. And what that is they have rocket engines on the bottom of that spacecraft. They fire, try to soften the blow with rocket engines. No airbags. It's a pretty rough hit, from what I've read. It's quite a shock when you land in a Soyuz vehicle. But nobody's got killed yet doing it. Back to you, sir.
So, I think you're saying that those rockets that soften the blow, that system has worked successfully every single time. Nobody had a hard landing that you know of. Paul, go ahead.
Well, they're all kind of hard landings. They say it's like a mild car crash when you land in the Soyuz. And part of that problem is the spacecraft tends to roll. The wind pulls the parachute, and it'll turn over and roll sometimes. And actually, they're bolted into their seats, so they're not going anywhere, but sometimes it's a bit of a rough ride. Peggy Whitson got roughed up one time. That was the last flight. She's been up to the space station three times, but she's up there now. She'll be back in September with Jack Fisher, the guy that my daughter's due to talk to. So they'll be back. And that's how they come back to the land in Cosmos. And I'll be glad when SpaceX and Boeing, get their act together and start going up in our vehicle. They look like they're so much well designed. Back to you.
This week, Paul, there is a picture on YouTube, where I think I saw it first, of this aircraft that has two fuselages, 385-foot wingspan. The biggest wingspan of any aircraft ever built, even bigger than the Spruce Goose. And these two fuselages, it's an aircraft that's now sitting in the Mojave Airport. I've been to the Mojave Airport, by the way, in California. And that's where they developed the Voyager, the one that flew around the Earth with one tank full of gas. But this aircraft is going to carry a spacecraft up to a very high altitude and then launch it, is the intention. I should have written down the name of it and the name of the organization building it. I wonder if you're familiar with this this aircraft, that they're about to start doing some flight tests with it. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is WS2N. Yeah, I talked about this thing many years ago when it was first under development. It's called the Strato Launch, the Stratosphere, Strato Launch, and it's being built, paid for by Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft, and what he's got is a big version of what Virgin Galactic calls the White Knight. White Knight is carrier plane that's going to be carrying eventually people up to space on the on Unity. They're spacecraft. We call it a spacecraft 2 or whatever. It's called Unity is the name. The first one crashed testing it. But now this is a big version of that carrier. It's got 6 jet engines pushing this thing. Each engine is a Pratt & Whitney engine. Same engine that 747 used. So probably each one's got over 50,000 pounds of thrust and drop. Strato Launch has 6 engines. Like you said, I think it's 380 feet. Biggest. If you were to put it on a football field, wingtip to wingtip, it's over the length of a football field, including the end zone. And it's got 2 fuselages, like you said. And how high? I think it was like a 5-story building or something, so probably 50 feet high. And they got it out of the hangar. They had to build a special hangar for this thing. But I don't expect to see it take the skies for probably another year or so. I think they're going to do tests, fuel tests, and different things. The thing weighs empty, 500,000 pounds. Eventually, when it goes up, it will be, I think, 1.5 million pounds. So figure the whole International Space Station weighs 1 million pounds. So it's going to weigh about that much. And then you take a 500,000-pound rocket, put it in the middle and drop it with a payload on board, and you can, blast that thing into space. There's no plans of putting people on that. I think they would have that capability in the future. They've already got the arrangements with Orbital ATK to launch future Pegasus rockets and maybe some other stuff, But Pegasus is a successful rocket that they do. Still launch now from the L-1011 big jet, full body jet. L-1011 takes up Pegasus rocket and they drop it, and it'll launch satellites like the New Star, one that's studying all these neutron stars now. It's been very successful with launch. I think over 40 launches with the Pegasus rocket. The last one was last year, probably around this time. They launched the Cygnus spacecraft. They launched 6 or 8 satellites in one shot. And they were studying water levels of the complex system. It's very interesting to watch this thing work. And instead of dropping it from that, they're going to be dropping the Pegasus rockets from Strato Launch. And Strato Launch would be able to carry something even bigger if they wanted to. This is a massive airplane. I guess you've seen it. They have people in little cars down below. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N. Question.
Go ahead, Joe.
Paul, the plane you were just talking about that has a wingspan bigger than a football field with payload, what do they estimate that the usable service ceiling is of that aircraft? I think they want to get up to 45,000-50,000 feet. I'll have to go back and research that again, but I think that's the drop height. That's where the L-1011 goes.
That Strato launcher, there's two numbers now, 500,000 pounds and 550,000 pounds. One is the weight of the aircraft empty, and the other one is the weight of the payload it can take. Now, a rocket being launched into space with a total weight of 500,000 pounds. That sounds a little bit light to me, Paul.